From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Coal burns. Dump it in a power plant and you can light up a city. And we've got a lot of it. But coal is also one of the dirtiest fossil fuels out there, releasing carbon dioxide and mercury and more into the air we breathe, the climate we need. Now the Supreme Court is getting into issues of regulation and how dirty coal can be. Congress is jumping in big time this hour on Point, the battle again over coal. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time to cap coal or make it pay its full cost to health and climate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With us first today from Charlottesville, Virginia, to look at the Supreme Court's impending consideration here is Supreme Court correspondent for Slate, Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hey there, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Why is the court getting into this issue? I mean, they didn't have to. They never have to, but they are. Why?
Right. Well, I think there's a lower court ruling. There's a 2-1 ruling out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and that ruling upheld the EPA's authority to regulate some of these toxic substances. And so the court, if they wanted to, they certainly could have left that ruling undisturbed. But they said, no, we want to take a look at this. And this is, I should say, one of several rulings that the court is going to make regarding the EPA's regulatory authority. So the court and the EPA are kind of locking horns over this. This is not by any means the first time the court's going to look at how the EPA interprets its own rules.
Congress passed the Clean Air Act way back in 1970. In 1990, they came back, amended the law, told the EPA to look at all these toxic substances, including mercury and arsenic and more. Said, get in there. They said the EPA shall regulate major sources of these pollutants where it is appropriate and necessary. Now you've got Michigan versus the EPA in this case. The court will begin looking at tomorrow. Michigan and 19 other, Republican-led states, Dahlia. I mean, when Congress says the EPA shall regulate major sources where appropriate and necessary, does that leave a lot of wiggle room or not?
You know, it seems like it doesn't, and I think the valence that you have to look at this through, and the court will look at it through, is that courts are supposed to defer to agencies. And so when the EPA says, we get to determine what appropriate and necessary means, then the court technically is supposed to give a lot of deference to that. The question that the challengers, and you're right, it's Michigan and a bunch of Republican-led states, they tend to be northern coal-burning states, and the challenge, they say, is that that word appropriate in the phrase appropriate and necessary means that the EPA needs to take costs into account, and that the EPA passed this unbelievable costly regulation without thinking through that it was going to be, in their view, the most expensive retrofitting that they have ever seen. And so what they basically say is, sure, go ahead and say what appropriate means, EPA, but it has to take costs into account and it has to do it in a meaningful way.
Okay, so there's all kinds of costs attendant to coal, and yes, some would be very real and material right there around plants. Some plants might not even be retrofittable from what I'm reading here. What do we know about how the court is likely to look at this? And is this going to be of a piece with other regulatory decisions on healthcare and beyond? Will they look at it on its own terms? And what kind of threat to this ruling, to the EPA action, do you see in the court at this point?
You know, it's so interesting you phrase it that way, Tom, because it does have echoes of the case that the court heard only a few weeks ago that had to do with Obamacare and whether an agency could determine for itself what its regulations meant. And so there are definitely echoes here of the court getting involved in a fight where an agency's interpretation of its own regulations is challenged in the court. You can't, I think, avoid the fact that this court really is in a bigger way saying Obama is guilty of all sorts of overreach, all sorts of overinterpreting of his own authority, and this is another of many of those. I think that the issue here really is going to be whether Justices Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts, and you'll remember we talked about them last month, whether they tend to do what they did last year in a big EPA case and say, you know what, we just have to defer. If the EPA says they took these costs into account, if the EPA says they made this determination appropriately and according to the law, then it's not our place for the courts to intercede, and that's certainly what the lower court said. So I think all eyes will be on those two justices again, because they tend to rule in these cases, at least in the environmental cases in the very recent past, they tend to rule for the EPA.
So that's a regulatory decision. Dahlia, can you get a read on whether there is on this court of nine justices a dominant environmental sensibility? I mean, are they thinking about what if this mercury was raining down on my kids or grandkids? Do they have an environmental attitude?
You know, it's such an interesting question because, of course, what the EPA is saying is, look, by enacting this regulation, which, by the way, is supposed to go into effect next month, they feel that they are preventing up to 11,000 premature deaths, 5,000 non-fatal heart attacks, 540,000 days of work lost to asthma. So there are real costs that the government says we are cleaning this up because real people are dying. Real pregnant women ingesting mercury are really having children with birth defects, and that matters. I don't know that the court responds to that in the same way that the court didn't seem all that responsive to arguments in the Burwell case where it was claimed, you know, people will lose health care, people will die. The court doesn't like to talk about those issues. What the court likes to do is say, how much do we defer to this agency when they have rules that say very, very broadly that the agency needs to do what is, quote, appropriate and necessary? That's the kind of statutory digging they're going to do. If they're worried about their grandkids and their pregnant daughters-in-law and the mercury, that just doesn't seem to affect the sensibility in chambers while they're arguing this case out.
The United States Supreme Court picks it all up tomorrow. Dahlia Lithwick covers the court for Slate. She joined us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Dahlia, you are terrific. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Here's the sound of a Manitowoc 6400 drag line digging anthracite coal in Pennsylvania. Big, huge. These are big operations, and they power a lot of America's electricity supply. Kate Shepard joins us now from Washington, energy and environment editor at Huffington Post. Kate, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're hearing so much lately about the war on coal. If there's a war of some kind here, what are the battle lines? We just heard the EPA trying to go after mercury and more in coal. What else is afoot right now, Kate, that has brought this battle over coal front and center again?
Well, in addition to the mercury rules, we have the development of greenhouse gas regulations that will affect coal-fired power plants across the U.S. The EPA put out their draft rules last June. They'll be finalizing them this summer as well, and then states will have to come up with their compliance plans in about a year from then. So that's underway, and that will affect all these coal plants as well. There are also rules about the disposal of coal ash from coal plants that the EPA has put out at the end of last year, which is another way that they are targeting the coal industry with new regulations.
So the carbon emission, is this the one that says that existing power plants would have to be 30% below 2005 levels by 2030? Is that
the Clean Power Plan is what the EPA has called it, and that would require that power plants across the country reduce their emissions 30% by 2030. There's also a rule that affects the emissions from new coal-fired power plants that's also being finalized at this point as well.
Can we assume then that the biggest burden of this would be on coal plants? Is it somehow easier for natural gas-fired plants to do this?
The biggest burden is on coal plants. Natural gas plants have some emissions as well, but they're much lower than coal plants.
Kate, what portion? I'm reading a few years back, it was something like half of the country's energy was supplied by coal. Where does that stand now?
Right now, coal provides about 40% of the U.S. power in the right now, and we burn about 924 million tons of coal per year in the U.S.
Okay. Is there a way that Congress might stop the carbon emissions initiative that the Obama administration has mounted here? Do they have means to do that?
Congress is trying. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has really been pushing hard to try to find ways to get Congress to step in and block these rules through a variety of different legislative measures. But the reality is, at this point in time, while the Republicans control the House and the Senate, they don't have enough votes in the Senate to really throw out this rule right now. They might try to find ways of interfering with the rule through appropriations bills and trying to block EPA from working on the rule. But it's probably going forward despite McConnell's efforts in Congress. But McConnell has started his own effort on the side aside to try to rally state governors across the country to not comply with the EPA rules. So he last week sent a letter to all 50 governors and asking them to basically disobey the EPA and not go forward with putting out a plan. And he sees that as a way of delaying action on this across the country, even if they can't block it in Congress right now.
So that would be a version, in a way, of states who refuse to go with a Medicare, Medicaid portion of the Obamacare.
Exactly.
Initiative.
It's for them, it's buying time, and it's also trying to create a legal case, much like this one we're seeing on Mercury right now, in which you've got states that are basically saying no and trying to, you know, get it through the court system and have another challenge against the EPA greenhouse gas rules.
I feel like we're on new territory all the time here. Is there any precedent for that? States just one by one saying no to EPA rules just because?
Well, I mean, you always see some states that have an opposition to the rules, just like with these mercury rules we're talking about here today. You'll always see some of that. But then you'll also see states who are coming to the EPA's defense. In the mercury case here today, there's, you know, also 17 states that are saying that this is good and we want to have this regulation because we're already doing more in our states and it should be a level playing field and it should be more fair going forward. I think what's interesting and perhaps unprecedented is having the Senate Majority Leader personally campaigning to get states to disobey the EPA.
Kate Shepard with the Huffington Post, please stand by in Washington. We are talking about the new and latest battle over coal. Hobo Jack Atkins behind us here with 30-inch coal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Riding on a lizard in 30-inch coal. That cable is sparking. That's a little wheels roll. Dear God, have mercy on a miner's soul, down on my poor knees in 30-inch coal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new and latest battle over coal. It's big, it's dirty, it's still powerful. It's before the Supreme Court. It's hot in Congress. It's a dirty old energy source that does not want to go away. And many Americans' power still comes from it. Kate Shepard is with us, energy and environment reporter at Huffington Post. Mitch McConnell, Senate Republican Majority Leader, Senate leader, has been on the bandwagon about this big time. Here he is all the way back in 2013, standing in front of the Capitol building in Washington at a rally for American energy jobs, said he was taking on the president's war on coal, he called it.
A war on coal is a war on all of Kentucky. And I'm here to tell you this fight has just begun. We're not giving up. We're going to push back against these people in every single way we can. We're going to stop this war on coal.
Well, there's still a battle on. Not clear at this point who's leading it exactly. Last week, Mitch McConnell sent out a letter to all 50 governors trying to convince states to block or ignore the EPA's carbon pollution regulations. One governor, Democrat Jerry Brown of California, who's facing a serious drought in his state, was not happy. He talked with Meet the Press on Sunday.
To have the leader of the Senate, right, Mr. McConnell, representing his coal constituents, putting at risk the health and well-being of America is a disgrace. This is a serious matter. We're experiencing it in California as kind of a foretaste, but there is no doubt that into the future, we're going to have more problems, and we have to do something, and President Obama is taking some important steps.
Right.
And to fight that, it borders on the immoral.
Governor Jerry Brown of drought-plagued California. Kate Shepard, please stand by in Washington. David Doniger joins us as well now, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. David Doniger, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
Step back and put all this action in context for us. What's going on, David?
Well, coal burning for electric power is the largest source of air pollution of all different kinds in the country. There's nothing else that comes close except the entire transportation system, which actually we've been busy cleaning up. But the coal-fired power plants are lagging behind. This is a struggle that was begun 45 years ago with the 1970 Clean Air Act, and it's been stretched out and stretched out and stretched out for 45 years. The power plants are the biggest source of the sulfur and nitrogen pollution that causes smog and soot and kills tens of thousands of people a year. The Obama administration put controls on the power plants for those pollutants, and those were upheld by the Supreme Court last April on a 6-2 vote. They're still not in effect, but mm-hmm. they've been upheld as a matter of law. The mercury standards will make big cuts in toxic mercury and other toxic air pollutants, and also further cuts in the sulfur and the NOx pollution, saving more than 10,000 lives per year if these go fully into effect. And in fact, most companies have already met the mercury requirements. This lawsuit is kind of late in getting to the Supreme Court. And the carbon requirements are the big piece that's left to complete. 2 billion tons per year of carbon dioxide come from the power plants, more than from any other source in the country. We have cleaner ways of generating electricity, and we won't get there overnight, but we need to have a steady transition from the dirty sources towards the clean sources.
We've got a lot of listeners with questions for you, David, and for Kate Shepard. We'll hear from a defender of coal in a moment. Robert Bryce will join us from Austin, Texas. Fred in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Fred, thank you for joining us. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Yes. When I was in Boulder, Colorado, a little more than 10 years ago, there was a power plant on the north end of the city, and it was the smoke coming out of that those facts were noticeably clean. A lot of time in other coal-fired plants, you see a black, soot-gray cloud moving away after the evaporation, and they filtered it. And and every once in a while, you see the train loads of these huge, long filters being hauled away from the plant. I'm wondering if that technology would be acceptable today. Has it improved since then? At 10 years, it should have. And I think we need the coal to keep our expenses down, since we have so many adversaries in the world, and we are the only ones, the largest contributor to the, the resistance to these adversaries.
Well, and we've got a lot of coal. Fred, I appreciate your call. David, what about it? How clean can it be? We've got a lot of coal in this country. Could we go on using it? Would that be cost effective?
You can clean up coal plants, and that's the point of these requirements. They need to clean up. They need to bear the costs of cleanup. And some of the plants will continue to run with these modern pollution controls. You can even take the carbon dioxide, capture it, and stick it underground. Some of the plants can continue to run if they are running clean. But frankly, the economics work against them, because the cheapest way to meet our energy needs is to use energy more efficiently in our homes, our equipment, our heating and cooling systems, our refrigerators, our lights, that suck less electricity and give you the same goods and services that you want. The other big alternatives are to generate electricity from wind and solar power, the costs of which are coming down really fast, and with natural gas, which is very plentiful and much less expensive than it used to be. So basically, coal is getting run out of the market, losing its advantage. That's why it's dropped from 50 to 40%. But if EPA's full suite of standards goes into effect, EPA projects we'll still be getting 30% of our electricity from coal in the year 2030. So this is a gradual change, but we have to do it. Otherwise, we're poisoning ourselves.
Kate, what's the argument that Mitch McConnell makes for coal? Is it environmental? Is it jobs? Is it cost?
Well, I'll channel my Mitch McConnell here, but his argument is largely about coal is currently a huge portion of our energy, that it would he worries that it would not be cost effective if we were to switch away from coal. And he also worries about jobs. And, Mitch McConnell is from a coal state, Kentucky, and he enjoys a mutually appreciative relationship with the coal industry in his state, who he supports them and they support him as a politician as well. So I think there are a lot of factors here in his argument for why we need to keep coal. But I think that, even the EPA says that with all these new rules, coal's not going to disappear from our energy supply. Really, what this will do is get rid of the oldest, dirtiest coal plants. The average age of the nation's coal fleet is 42 years. More than half of the coal plants in the U.S. are older than 40 years. It's the oldest, dirtiest ones that will need to close. The cleaner, newer ones could probably go forward because they are operating in a more cost-effective way than these old, dirty ones.
What's the role of the coal industry itself in here, David? energy producers in these lawsuits, let's say?
The coal industry, together with the oil and gas industry, these are the big polluters, and they put more than $700 million into electing the current majority of the Republican Congress. So a lot of what's going on now is the dirty little secret of today's American politics. Congress serves who pays for their electoral campaigns. The coal industry is behind lawsuits against the mercury rules and against the carbon rules. There are actually power companies on EPA's side supporting EPA that the cleanup is feasible, the cleanup is affordable, and it should go forward.
And what about the jobs argument, David?
Well, if you look in Kentucky, there are about 13,000 coal miners' jobs still. There are hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs in Kentucky. This is why Governor Beshear of the state of Kentucky is going ahead with a clean air plan, because he and his administration are trying to figure out a way to make the transition, to bring in more gas, more renewables, more efficiency. They'll still have in Kentucky an electric supply that's 70 or 80% coal-fired in 15 or 20 years under the Beshear plan. But they'll be in compliance with the Clean Air Act, and they'll be moving in the right direction. They'll be protecting the manufacturing base, which is much larger in Kentucky than the coal miners. And at the same time, there'll still be a lot of coal mined and used in Kentucky. So there's a future even for the coal miners. McConnell is playing not so much to those workers. He's playing to the big polluters who are bankrolling the electoral campaigns.
And to our caller, thinking about Colorado and the coal plants that he saw there, David, what about the cost to the economy if all these regulations are implemented and everybody complies and pays what's necessary to clean up? What's the net cost to the economy, and how do you look at net cost overall? How do you take into consideration environmental and health costs too?
Well, here's the thing: we don't have to make this choice, because if you use energy efficiency and the cleaner forms of energy, which are cheaper in many instances now than coal, the Environmental Protection Agency projects, and we project, that by 2030, Americans' electric bills will be going down. You may be paying a little bit more per kilowatt hour, but if you're using less because your energy, your heating and cooling system and your light bulbs and your refrigerator are sucking less power, you're actually a net winner. Just like if you have a fuel-efficient car, you can save money on gas even if gas prices go up. So we can have these huge public health and environmental benefits. We can cut the carbon pollution by 30% and slow down climate change. We can cut the other pollutants by enough to save another 5,000, 6,000 lives, EPA projects, above and beyond what the mercury rules will do. And this is every year. And these benefits are worth tens of billions of dollars per year, and the costs are under $10 billion a year. So you're talking about 10 to 1. Benefits over costs.
Marianne is calling from Troy, Michigan. Michigan, right in the middle of this Supreme Court fight. Marianne, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I think it's terrible that they still want to use coal in this day and age. And my father grew up in the Thumb of Michigan in the olden days, and he was 83, and he just died last year.
Yeah.
And he went to school in a one-room schoolhouse there in Michigan in the Thumb. And he used to have to go, they would make the boys take turns and go out in the yard of the school and get coal and put it in this burning, you know, like a fire coal fireplace thing to keep
yeah,
the heat.
Yeah, sure. Him and a lot of other people back in the day, sure.
Right. And he died of lung cancer and stuff, and he had, different problems, and they acted like that was normal. And I don't think that they should have all the governors trying to push and ignore the EPA and President Obama about coal.
Marianne, I hear you loud and clear. Of course, your state is in the forefront of contesting this before the Supreme Court right now. But I appreciate your call from Troy, Michigan. I want to go to Austin, Texas, if I may. Kate Shepard, David Doniger, please stand by. Robert Bryce joins us right now. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Energy Policy and the Environment. Robert Bryce, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us. Are you there, Mr. Bryce?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on. What's the argument that you would make on the coal front? Should we go with cleaner coal? Should we bite the bullet and, you know, absorb the cost of cleaning it up? Is there a reason not to?
Well, yes. I mean, sure. I'm in favor of cleaner coal, and we're seeing that in some regards here in the U.S. I agree with Kate Shepard. What we're going to see in the next few years is going to be the retirement of a lot of older coal plants. You look at the EIA's projections, we're looking at a retirement of about 60,000 megawatts of coal-fired capacity here in the U.S. by 2020. So, but I mean, just to step back, Tom, I think what's happening here is that the coal industry is being squeezed, and they're fighting back. You've seen just in the last decade or so, domestic coal consumption is down by about 19%. There are no new coal-fired power plants being built in the United States. But the move toward cleaner coal, the other problem the coal industry faces right now is one of cost. If you look at the coal plant that was a cleaner coal plant that was recently finished here in the United States, Prairie State Energy Campus in Southern Illinois, mm-hmm. is a very expensive plant, but it will meet all of the mercury rules. It won't meet the clean power plan rules for CO2, but it's using supercritical technology, and I'm in favor of your Mr. Doniger from NRDC talked about using energy more efficiently. That's where I come down on the coal question, is we need to be building plants that use coal more efficiently, and the Prairie State plant uses supercritical technology, ultra-supercritical technology. Coal isn't going away, but we need to be using it more efficiently and burning it more cleanly.
Now, of course, these energy companies are in business, and they want the biggest profit margin they can muster, but should that be the country's first concern, or should we be more concerned about the environment, health costs, environmental costs? I mean, is their urge to profit more important than the country's need to clean up, Robert?
Well, look, there's always a balance, and this is always the tension between government and regulation. What is the proper balance? And that's what this whole fight is about. But I think, Tom, it's important to just zoom back a little bit here and put America's coal use into perspective globally. Yes, the U.S. is a big coal user, but the idea that the Clean Power Plan, which is going to be the next big issue that's going to be litigated nationally in terms of the EPA's ability to limit CO2 emissions, yes, CO2 emissions in the U.S. are falling. In fact, the U.S. is leading the world in reducing its CO2 emissions. But all over the world, countries from Germany to Poland to Indonesia, Japan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, what are they doing? They're building coal-fired power plants. They're doing exactly what the United States did during their push to industrialize. So, yes, we can be more efficient. Yes, we should be pushing for more efficient coal plants. But the idea that we're going to make a significant difference, at least when it comes to the CO2 emissions globally, it's clear that the Clean Power Plan, which is, as I said, is the other big looming issue, it's not going to make a significant difference in global CO2 emissions. And I think it's the promise that has been put forward by the EPA that this is going to make a significant difference, simply not true.
But, I mean, does that mean we should just throw in the towel on CO2 emissions because other countries are going to do it?
No, I didn't say that. But I'm pointing
out what it sounded like.
Well, look, global CO2 emissions are rising at a pace of over 500 million tons per year. When you look at the Clean Power Plan, what the objective is to reduce CO2 emissions from the electricity sector by roughly 30% by 2030. So it's a reduction of around 720 million tons by 2030. Globally, in 2011 alone, global CO2 emissions rose by 723 million tons. The U.S. is leading the world in efficiency and reducing CO2 emissions. We should be helping the developing world in energy-efficient technology.
Robert Bryce, hold the thought. Kate Shepard, David Doniger, we'll be right back. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio.
Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new and latest battle over coal. It is big, it is dirty, it is still powerful. It's before the Supreme Court now. It is hot again in Congress. It's dirty old energy source that does not want to go away. A lot of Americans rely on it for their energy still. What do we do about coal? Kate Shepard is with us, energy and environment reporter at Huffington Post. Robert Bryce, he's with the Manhattan Institute's Center for Energy Policy and the Environment, joining us today from Austin, Texas. And David Doniger with the Natural Resources Defense Council, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program there. David Doniger, you hear Robert Bryce make the argument that all over the world people are going to coal, and therefore the kind of implication is it doesn't make sense for us to get whiplash going against it.
I think that's really changing now. And the key moment was in November when President Obama and President Xi of China announced jointly that each country was going to take significant steps to change its trajectory and start curbing the carbon pollution. The Chinese have committed to a cap topping out on carbon pollution by 2030 or before. And since the visit by Obama in November, the Chinese have been preparing a new law, a new policy that would cap the total amount of coal used as early as 2020. They are changing, and they are the fastest developer of wind power and solar power in the world. If the U.S. and China strike a different path, which they have done, it sends a powerful signal to the rest of the world, and we're headed towards a meeting of global leaders in Paris in December, where it's to be hoped that countries will really put real commitments to change their carbon pollution trajectories. And it will all add up to something. It will start to bend the curve and change the dangerous pathway that we are on.
Now, does U.S. policy matter when it comes to that?
All of this comes down to the credibility and the leverage of the United States has always been in short supply in these climate talks. And Obama has established our credibility and our leverage by using the existing Clean Air Act, the way it was intended to be used, to fight American pollution and show that we are doing our part. And that gives us the credibility to ask others to do theirs.
Kate Shepard, is this what the White House is saying? We need this in our back pocket when we go to the big international global meeting on climate and energy in Paris?
Absolutely. This is the Obama administration's argument is that we need to be leading here in the U.S. and that this is the U.S.'s role in these negotiations is to be really putting our own stake out there and saying that we are making a difference and this is what we're doing at home. And that will guide other countries to take those steps as well. And that's also why you saw last week the White House announced that they are increasing the emissions targets for the federal agencies to try to cut their emissions 40% in the next 10 years so that they we can lead by example and show that it is possible to make these emissions cuts and still see economic growth and still be, you know, a significant player in the world.
Robert Bryce, I'm reading you here, writing recently, nothing will be achieved at the climate confab in Paris. We've seen this movie before. Again, it sounds a little bit like throwing in the towel. Does it matter for U.S. leadership if we can hope for that, that the U.S. have a tough policy or clean policy on coal, Bob?
Sure. I understand the question, but I think what we've seen, whether it was Copenhagen or Bonn or Durban or Cancun, we've seen this movie before, right? Which is that the developing countries around the world are going to look after their own interests. And in particular, they're looking after their own interests when it comes to electricity availability. Tom, there are about 1.2 billion people globally who lack access to electricity at all. In India alone, there are more than 300 million people. the Prime Minister of India, Modi, recently said they're not going to sacrifice economic growth in the name of CO2 emissions reductions. So what's India doing? They're planning to add about 90,000 megawatts of new coal-fired capacity over the next 5 years or so globally. And I issued a report on this for the Manhattan Institute last October. Globally, we're looking at the addition of something on the order of 500 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity globally. I understand what Mr. Doniger is saying. Yes, we're seeing a move toward efficiency. We're seeing moves globally toward getting more effective work out of each energy unit of energy that we consume. But the global trend is toward coal. And last point, in December, the IEA, the International Energy Agency in Paris, projected that by 2020, global coal use will exceed global oil use on a BTU basis. It's an astounding prediction.
David, what does that mean? We're fried no matter what?
I think all these projections are changing. I think policy is changing these projections. Leadership can change the direction. The Indians are also swimming in the thickest smog in the world in New Delhi. So Prime Minister Modi knows that he has to clean that up. The Chinese are motivated to clean up their pollution because it's one of the biggest sources of political and social unrest in their one-party state. They need to address this problem. And this is happening all over the world. So it's true that we need to find ways to bring the benefits of electricity to everybody in the world. But we need to do it in ways that are cleaner than the way we used to do it. The world can't survive if everybody repeats what has been done, what was done in the United States, what we've cleaned up. But what's now being done in Delhi and what's now going on in Beijing, that's why they themselves know they have to clean it up.
Listeners writing in on Facebook and beyond here, Mark says, I see a war on our future by the coal industry. Bill says, if you burn coal, you should pay the full cost of cleaning up its damage. This is the cost of removing its CO2, capturing it. This would cost so much more than renewables and conservation that nobody would burn it. Ed in Lake Worth, Florida. Ed, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I don't know where to begin. This is kind of like if there was a huge lobby in ancient Rome saying, save the lead pipes. You know, it's we have groups like the Koch brothers, the Manhattan Institute, the Heartland Institute that are just cravenly at the behest of the fossil interests. We get enough solar energy alone, not even counting wind or tidal, in a half an hour to an hour that lands on the U.S. to power the whole country for a year. Places like Germany are now running 25 to 50% solar, places that are cloudy more than half of the time. The climate deniers are saying, oh, we're not really having global warming. Well, fine, save the coal for the coming ice age. There might be a way to use this stuff in the future. But it's known right now that if the known fossil reserves on this planet were all burned, it would raise the temperature of the Earth 6 degrees Celsius, which would basically be a hell on earth.
Ed, what do you say to Robert Bryce's argument that we're going to see 500 gigawatts more coal come on streaming globally in the years ahead? So why should we?
If these guys have their way. If these guys have their way, maybe. I mean, I remember a few years
back. All right. Can I interrupt you?
No, you can't, but I will come to you in one moment, Bob. Sorry, Ed Rapper, and we'll go to Bob.
Okay, they have said, you know, years ago that, oh, we'll never be using solar, and there are places that are harnessing solar big time.
Ed, we've got it. Robert Bryce, what do you say to this critique?
You know, listen, if you have the facts, you pound the facts. You have the law, you pound the law. If you don't have the facts or the law, you pound the table. This man's attacking me personally. He's attacking Manhattan Institute. I'm used to this. Look.
Well, I mean, there are think tanks with substantial backing from fossil fuel interests. That's not debatable.
I understand this, and I've heard it all before. Listen, if this man thinks that there's some conspiracy afoot, then why doesn't he go to Hanoi and talk to the Vietnamese and tell them, oh, the Koch brothers are demanding that you build a coal-fired power plant? Why doesn't he go to Seoul, South Korea, where they're building a thousands of megawatts of new coal-fired capacity? What about Bangladesh? The day after the People's March for Climate in New York City in September, the Bangladeshis did a deal with the Malaysians to build a new ultra-supercritical coal-fired power plant in Bangladesh. Is this part of some massive conspiracy to deny global warming? This is individual countries pursuing their individual interests and trying to bring their people out of poverty. This claim that, you know, oh, there's some massive conspiracy afoot. Yes, it's a massive conspiracy afoot by individual political leaders to represent their people and to bring them
out of the dark.
Well, hang on a second. I mean, there are definitely, you don't have to say conspiracy. You can say interests. Companies do have interests, and they certainly lobby for those interests in this country on a great scale. I'm not sure, though, I want to understand what you're saying, Bob. If more is coming on stream around the world, why exactly should the U.S. join that parade?
I'm not saying the U.S. should join that parade. What we're seeing in the U.S., coal is being displaced largely because of lower-cost natural gas. One of the reasons why I think the clean power plant in particular is not needed is that the market is working largely against the coal-fired industry right now because natural gas is undercutting it on price.
Why not clean it up in any case and incur the economic cost in order to gain the environmental and health benefits? Why not do it in this country, one of the richest countries in the world?
Sure. And I think that that's underway because some of these older coal-fired power plants simply aren't economic either on an energy basis, and they can't meet the clean air standards. So what we're going to see is those coal-fired power plants go by the wayside. But what I don't think should happen is that the U.S. should forestall or prohibit the use of coal, which is the resource that we have not just in abundance but in superabundance. We're not the Saudi Arabia of coal. We're the OPEC of coal. We have more coal than any other country in the world.
David, if coal paid its full freight, paid for all of its costs, in not just financial, but also health and environmental, would it be competitive?
I don't know if it would be competitive, but it would be permissible from our point of view. It would be the point of NRDC's not against a mineral. NRDC's against pollution. And if the pollution can be controlled so that it doesn't endanger our health and our climate, then any form of energy that is not polluting should be allowed to compete in the marketplace. And if it can do so successfully carrying those costs, well, so be it.
Kate Shepard, what about energy companies in this country and their lobbying around the issues that we now see before Congress and, for that matter, before the Supreme Court? What is the role that these companies with very large interests are playing in this debate?
Well, of course, you see them bringing court cases. There's several that are involved in this mercury case, like the National Mining Association, and in addition to the states that are bringing the case. And they're obviously pushing against these rules through legal measures, as well as by pushing on people in Congress to support their interests as well. But I think, as David pointed out earlier, especially on the mercury issue, you see some power plants and power companies on the other side as well. Companies that are already doing a lot to cut emissions are saying, look, we're doing it. We're doing it already. Everyone should have to do it as well. And it would be a leveling the playing field for all of us. So it's not like all power companies are unified mm-hmm. against this mercury rule.
Mitch in Madison, Wisconsin. Mitch, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm concerned by the risk of long-term reliance on costly coal. Here in Madison, I saw a report by a citizen group named Repower Madison that's showing MG&E is tied to 70% coal until 2038 through some long-term coal contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also seen MG&E change the way that they bill their customers to reduce incentives for solar.
So long-term contracts. David Doniger, how about it? Are those a big issue when it comes to changing our energy mix?
Well, most power companies these days don't want to be in long-term contracts because, when the price of natural gas fell, when the price of solar and wind falls, companies locked into long-term coal contracts find themselves in a bad economic spot. So you see more and more of the power market is responsive to market forces in the short term, and that's the way it should be. And that allows energy efficiency and cleaner energy to compete with fossil fuels, both coal and gas. And that's as it should be. If we have pollution rules that make every source of power bear its own health and environmental costs, and we have a marketplace to compete in, you get the best results.
Joe in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Joe, you're on the air.
I just wanted to, as briefly as I can, bring up the environmental cost of extraction, which I haven't heard in this conversation, specifically various strip mining practices, including topping, which is something that's really having an enormous effect on West Virginia and Kentucky as well.
Topping, you mean taking the top right off the hill or mountain where the coal is?
Which is bad enough, but then you take the removed material and fill in valleys with it and have a tremendous impact on the freshwater resources of the area.
Yeah, Joe, we've talked about that on this show. We don't have time to get deeply into it today, but we know that is a factor Robert Bryce, what do you expect from the Supreme Court in terms of its ruling? What do you think is going to happen with the clean power requirements here? Do you see the states rising up and resisting at Mitch McConnell's encouragement?
Gee, Tom, my crystal ball on that, it's pretty cloudy. I guess overall, I'd say on the latter part, the clean power plan, it appears to me what's happening with this is the Obama administration is trying to use the EPA to do bureaucratically what they couldn't do legislatively.
But there is legislation from 1970, from 1990.
Yes, but not for CO2, where we had the Waxman-Markey bill failed. We couldn't get into the, we couldn't pass that through Congress. So now we're trying to attempt to do what they couldn't do legislatively through the bureaucracy. I think effectively what they're doing is trying to put a tax on CO2. And in my view, the Constitution says tax bills have to originate in the House. That hasn't happened here. But I don't have a projection, Tom. I don't know what the court's going to do on this. I think Dahlia Lithwick would be far better qualified to address that than I.
Kate, let me put the political side of this to you. The Clean Power Plan, does it look as though we may indeed see individual states rise up to resist the EPA here at the encouragement of Mitch McConnell?
I mean, we already see at least a dozen states that are saying that they won't go forward with the EPA plan. But I think what's interesting is that the way the Clean Power Plan is structured, states are supposed to come up with their own plans for meeting these emissions cuts. The EPA argues that it's better for states to come up with their own plan rather than having a plan given to them by the federal government. That way, the states are taking into account the realities on the ground that they face, and then they're coming up with a plan that works for them. So I think that more states will be going forward than you anticipate right now.
Of course, we saw with Obamacare, the states that then just said, okay, we'll just sit on our hands. Could that happen again here?
It could.
David Doniger, we hear where you'd like it to go. Is it going to?
I don't think states will sit on their hands because they know that it's better for them to tailor their own plans to their own conditions than have EPA do it. And that's the Federal Clean Air Act is the guarantee that somebody will do it because it's a national problem and a national responsibility.
David Doniger at the NRDC in Washington, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program there. Thank you for joining us today, David.
Thank you.
Robert Bryce in Austin, Texas at the Manhattan Institute Center for Energy Policy and the Environment. Robert, thanks for being here.
Thanks a million.
And Kate Shepard at the Huffington Post. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.